Was it God's will it should be so? Dr. Warren meant, was it crippled from birth? If so, it would be harder for him to help. Yes, said Johnny, thinking of how he had ruined it upon a Lord's day. God's will be done, said the young doctor. He went back to his writing. 3. Outside, Johnny could hear shouting, yelling, whistles, the running of feet. With the coming of night, the Sons of Liberty were abroad, tacking up Mr. Adams' placards. Tonight Rab was not out with them, although he had been off once or twice of late helping to frighten the tea consignees out of Boston to the protection of a handful of British soldiers stationed on Castle Island. Johnny was too young to be a son. But when the observers met, the boys always stayed in the room below to run errands for them, and it was always Rab who mixed the fragrant punch with which the meetings ended. All over Boston was a feeling of excitement. Everyone knew that the Dartmouth was but a few miles away. Great events were brewing. Johnny went to the door to see what the clamor was. A courageous Tory was chasing the men whom he had found tacking a placard on his property. They had let him chase them thus far to a dark salt lane, and now had turned on him. Such street brawling made Johnny feel sick. He closed the door, sat down beside Rab, and began slicing lemons, oranges, and limes. Rab? Yes? What will they decide, those men upstairs? You heard Sam Adams. If possible, the ships will sail home again with their tea. We've got 20 days. But if the governor won't agree? He won't. You don't know Hutchinson. I do. And you saw how happy Sam was this morning? He knows the governor a lot better than I do. And then... And what next, Rab? Johnny heard blows and oaths from the street outside. His hands shook. He put down the knife so Rab wouldn't know. They were doing something, something awful to the Tory. As soon as we go upstairs with our punch, we'll know. Look at Sam Adams. If he looks as pleased as an old dog fox with a fat pullet in his mouth, we'll know they've agreed to violence if everything else fails. He doesn't care much any more about our patching up our differences with England. He'd just about welcome a war. But the King's warships are in the harbor. They'll protect the tea, they'll fight. We can fight, too. Rab was putting the last delicate touches to his kettle full of brew, for tonight the punch would be hot. He was grating nutmegs, cautiously sprinkling in cloves, and breaking up cinnamon bark. Taste it, Johnny. That Madeira Mr. Hancock brought with him is first class. But Johnny heard a low moaning in the street, close to the shut door. That Tory who had been so brave and foolish as to allow the Sons of Liberty down a back alley was alone now, was sobbing, not from pain but from humiliation. Johnny declined to taste the punch. Mr. Lorne called down the ladder. Boys, you ready with your punch? They made up their minds fast tonight, said Rab. I rather thought they would. Johnny carried a handful of pewter cups and the big wooden bowl. Rab followed with 2 pitchers of his spicy brew. The attic where the boys commonly slept looked strange enough with those chairs pulled out and arranged for the meeting. John Hancock sat in the moderator's chair. His face looked white and drawn. Probably his head still ached. Beside him was Sam Adams, leaning toward him, whispering and whispering. Johnny thought how the Tories were saying that Sam Adams seduced John Hancock, even as the devil had seduced Eve, by a constant whispering in his ear. Adams turned his face as Johnny set down the wooden bowl on the baize-covered box before the moderator. Johnny had never seen an old dog fox with a fat pullet in his mouth, but he recognized the expression when he saw it. Rab poured the punch, and instantly the tense silence was broken. The men were on their feet, crowding up about the bowl. Rab and Johnny were well known. Here was Paul Revere clinking his cup with Rab, and John Hancock was telling Johnny how far too well his old slave woman guarded his privacy. Actually, 3 men had come to the house to tell him the first of the tea ships had been sighted, but he had not known anything was afoot until he got Johnny's bill on his tray. Then he guessed what had happened.
"Here's to December the 16th. Here, here."
They drank to that last day, the day on which the tea must be destroyed. unless it was allowed to return to England, and Johnny saw that Sam Adams had carried them all with him. They did not honestly want the tea returned and a peaceful settlement made. They wanted grievances and more grievances. Well, yes, armed warfare. Things were in such a state they did not honestly believe there could be any permanent, friendly settlement with the mother country. Johnny looked about through the haze of tobacco smoke. There was Dr. Warren. He was talking with Uncle Lorne and John Adams about that article he had written for the newspaper. Suddenly he lifted his head, smiled, almost laughed. Johnny did not know why Warren smiled. Why had Johnny been such a fool? Why couldn't he have shown his hand to the doctor? He bit into his lower lip. After his rudeness to Dr. Warren, he did not see how he could ever go to him and say, "I've changed my mind. I wanted to look at it. I think you're the only person in the world who can help me." So when Dr. Warren, a little later, looked toward Johnny, ready to smile, forgive his discourtesy, the boy looked away. He was so embarrassed, he was rude again. Sam Adams was standing at the far end of the room, and Mr. Hancock still sat, his head in his hands. Adams clapped slightly, and instantly conversation stopped. "Gentlemen," he said, "tonight we have made our decision, and know the method by which the detested tea can be destroyed, if the ships are not allowed to return. Here we have with us two of exactly, the sort of boys or young men we intend to use for our great purpose. Two boys in whom we have implicit trust. If it is the wish of the assembled club members, I suggest we approach them with our proposition tonight. Enlist their aid. 20 days will be up before we know. We'd best get on with our plans." The members once more took their seats, but the pewter cups of punch were passing from hand to hand. Only Will Molyneux was too restless to sit. He was muttering to himself. Ben Church sat alone. He often did. No one really liked him. All agreed the boys were to be told. "First," Adams said to the boys, "raise your right hands. Swear by the great name of God himself never, for as long as you live, to divulge to anyone the secret matters now entrusted to you. Do you so swear?" The boys swore. Hancock was not looking at them. He sat with his aching head in his hands. "There is no chance, not one, those ships will be allowed to return. The mass meetings, which will be held almost daily demanding the return of the tea, are to arouse public opinion and to persuade the world we did not turn to violence until every other course had been blocked to us. When the 20 days are up, on the night of the 16th of December, those ships are going to be boarded. That tea will be dumped in Boston Harbor. For each ship, the Dartmouth, the Eleanor, and the brig, the Beaver, we will need 30 stout, honest, fearless men and boys. Will you be one, Rab?" He did not say Rab and Johnny, as the younger boy noticed. Was this because he thought Johnny too cripple-handed for chopping open sea chests? Or merely because he knew Rab better and he was older? "Of course, sir." "How many other boys could you find for the night's work? Strong and trustworthy boys. For if 1 ounce of tea is stolen, the whole thing becomes a robbery. Not a protest." Rab thought. 8 or 10 tonight, but give me a little time so I can feel about a bit and I can furnish 15 or 20. "Boys who can keep their mouths shut?" "Yes." Paul Revere said, "I can furnish 20 or more from North Square." "Not one is to be told in advance just what the work will be, nor who the others are, nor the names of the men who instigated this tea party. That is, the gentlemen gathered here tonight. Simply as they love their country and liberty and hate tyranny, they are to gather in this shop on the night of December 16th, carrying with them such disguises as they can think of, and each armed with an axe or a hatchet." "It will be as you say." The discussion became more general. Each of these three groups must have a leader, men who could keep discipline. "I'll go, for one," said Paul Revere. Dr. Warren warned him. "Look here, Paul, it has been decided this work must be done by apprentices, strangers, folk little known about Boston. The East India Company may bring suit. If you're recognized..." "I'll risk it." Uncle Lorne was motioning to the boys to leave the conspirators. They did not want to leave, but they did. 4. Both the boys were in their truckle beds. The loft still smelled of tobacco and the spices of the punch. Johnny moved restlessly on his bed. Rab?
Huh?
Rab, those boys you promised. Am I one?
Of course.
But my hand. What will we have to do? Chop open tea chests, dump tea in the harbor?
Rab?
How can I ever chop?
You've 20 days to practice in. Logs in backyard need splitting.
Rab. But the older boy was asleep. Johnny was so wide awake he couldn't close his eyes. Old meeting struck midnight. He settled himself again. Surely if he tried hard enough, he could sleep. He was thinking of those tea ships. The Dartmouth, the Eleanor, the Beaver. Great white sails spread softly, sweeping on and on through the night to Boston. Nearer, nearer. He was almost asleep, twitched, and was wide awake. He would not think of the tea ships, but of those logs in the backyard he would practice on. He thought of Dr. Warren. Oh, why had he not let him see his hand? Scylla, waiting and waiting for him at North Square. And then he got there only about when it pleased him. He loved Scylla. She and Rab were the best friends he had ever had. Why was he mean to her? He couldn't think. He would take an axe in his left hand and chop, chop, chop. So he fell asleep. Something large and white was looming over him, about to run him down. He struggled awake, sat up, and found he was sweating. It was the great sails of the tea ships. From the bed next to him, he heard the soft, slow breathing of the older boy. So much more involved than Johnny in the brewing storm, Rab had been able to drop off immediately. Somehow Johnny must draw into himself something of Rab's calm, his nerveless strength. He began to breathe in unison with the sleeping boy. So slowly, so softly. He fell into a heavy sleep. 5. Next morning, Johnny was up and out in the backyard early. At first, it seemed impossible to hold an axe in his left hand, steady it with his bad right. He gritted his teeth and persevered. Rab said nothing of his struggles. He merely set type, pulled proofs as usual. But often he was gone from home, and Johnny knew he was feeling about for those 15 to 20 boys he had promised. Would the others go and Johnny be left behind? He could not bear the thought, and Rab had promised him in that 20 days he might learn to chop. Having finished the logs in Mr. Lorne's backyard, he began chopping, free gratis, for the Afric Queen. Almost every day, and sometimes all day, the mass meetings at Old South Church went on. Tempers grew higher and higher. Boston was swept with a passion it had not known since the Boston Massacre 3 years before. Riding this wild storm was Sam Adams and his trusty henchmen, directing it, building up the anger until, although the matter was not publicly mentioned, they would all see the only thing left for them to do was to destroy the tea. Sometimes Rab and Johnny went to these meetings. It happened they were there when the sheriff arrived and bade the meeting forthwith to disperse. He said it was lawless and treasonable. This proclamation from Governor Hutchinson was met with howls and hisses. They voted to disobey the order. Sometimes the boys slipped over to Griffin's Wharf. By the 8th of December, the Eleanor had joined the Dartmouth. These were strange ships. They had unloaded their cargoes, except the tea. The town of Boston had ordered them not to unload the tea, and the law stated they could not leave until they had unloaded. Nor would the governor give them a pass to return to England. At Castle Island, the British Colonel Leslie had orders to fire upon them if they attempted to sneak out of the harbor. The Active and the Kingfisher, British men of war, stood by ready to blast them out of the water if they obeyed the town and returned to London with the tea. The ships were held at Griffin's Wharf as though under an enchantment. Here was none of the usual hustle and bustle. Few of the crew were in sight, but hundreds of spectators gathered every day merely to stare at them. Johnny saw Roch, the 23-year-old Quaker who owned the Dartmouth, running about in despair. The governor would not let him leave. The town would not let him unload. Between them, he was a ruined man. He feared a mob would burn his ship. There was no mob, and night and day armed citizens guarded the ships. They would see to it that no tea was smuggled ashore and that no harm was done to the ships. Back and forth paced the guard. Many of their faces were familiar to Johnny. One day, even John Hancock took his turn with a musket on his shoulder, and the next night he saw Paul Revere. Then on the 15th, the third of the tea ships arrived. This was the brig, the Beaver. 6. The next day, the 16th, Johnny woke to hear the rain drumming sadly on the roof, and soon enough once more he heard all the bells of Boston cling-clanging, bidding the inhabitants come once more, and for the last time, to Old South to demand the peaceful return of the ships to England. By nightfall, when the boys' rabbits elected began silently to congregate in the office of the Observer, behind locked doors, the rain stopped. Many of them Johnny knew. When they started to assume their disguises, smooch their faces with soot, paint them with red paint, pull on nightcaps, old frocks, torn jackets, blankets with holes cut for their arms, they began giggling and laughing at each other. Rab could silence them with one look, however. No one passing outside the shop must guess that toward 20 boys were at that moment dressing themselves as Indians. Johnny had taken some pains with his costume. He had sewed for hours on the red blanket Mrs. Lorne had let him cut up, and he had a fine mop of feathers standing upright in the old knitted cap he would wear on his head. But when he started to put on his disguise, Rab said, "No, wait a minute." Then he divided the boys into three groups. Beside each ship at the wharf, they would find a band of men. "You," he said to one of the group of boys, "will join the boarding party for the Dartmouth. You for the Eleanor, you for the Beaver." Each boy was to speak softly to the leader and say, "Me know you," for that was the countersign. They would know the three leaders because each of them would wear a white handkerchief about the neck and a red string about the right wrist. Then he turned to Johnny. "You can run faster than any of us. Somehow, get to Old South Church. Mr. Roch will be back from begging once more the governor's permission for the ships to sail within a half hour. Now, Johnny, you are to listen to what Sam Adams says next. Look you, if Mr. Adams then says, 'Now may God help my country, come back here,' then we will take off our disguises and each go home and say nothing. But if he says, 'This meeting can do nothing more to save the country,' you are to get out of that crowd as fast as you can, and as soon as you get into Cornhill, begin to blow upon this silver whistle. Run as fast as you are able back here to me and keep on blowing. I'll have boys posted in dark corners, close enough to the church, but outside the crowd. Maybe we'll hear you the first time you blow." About Old South, standing in the streets, inside the church, waiting for Roch to return with the very last appeal that could be made to the governor, was the greatest crowd Boston had ever seen. Thousands upon thousands. There was not a chance, not one, Johnny could ever squirm or wriggle his way inside, but he pushed and shoved until he stood close to one of the doors. Farther than this he could not go, unless he walked on people's heads. It was dark already. Josiah Quincy's voice rang out from within. "I see the clouds roll and the lightning play, and to that God who rides the whirlwind and directs the storm, I commit my country." The words thrilled Johnny, but this was not what he was waiting for, and it was not Sam Adams speaking. He was bothered with only one thing. Quincy had a beautiful carrying voice. It was one thing to hear him and another Sam Adams who did not speak well at all. The crowd made way for a chaise. "Roch is back! Make way for Roch!" Mr. Roch passed close to Johnny. He was so young he looked almost ready to cry. This was proof enough that the governor had still refused. Such a turmoil followed Roch's entry. Johnny could not hear any one particular voice. What chance had he of hearing Sam Adams' words? He had his whistle in his hand, but he was so jammed into the crowd about the door that he did not believe he would be able to get his hand to his mouth.
"Silence!" That was Quincy again. "Silence, silence, Mr. Adams will speak."
Johnny twisted and turned and brought the whistle to his lips. And suddenly there was silence. Johnny guessed there were many in that crowd who, like himself, were hanging on those words. Seemingly, Mr. Adams was calmly accepting defeat, dismissing the meeting, for now he was saying,
"This meeting can do nothing more to save the country."
Johnny gave his first shrill blast on his whistle, and he heard whistles and cries seemingly in all directions, Indian war whoops,
"And Boston Harbor a teapot tonight! Hooray for Griffin's Wharf! Saltwater tea! Hi, Mohawks, get your axes and pay no taxes!"
Johnny was only afraid all would be over before Rab and his henchmen could get to the wharf. Still shrilling on the whistle, he fought and floundered against the tide of the crowd. It was sweeping towards Griffin's Wharf, he struggling to get back to Salt Lane. Now he was afraid the others would have gone on without him. After all, Rab might have decided that Johnny's legs and ears were better than his hands and deliberately let him do the work that best suited him. Johnny pushed open the door. Rab was alone. He had Johnny's blanket coat, his ridiculous befeathered knitted cap in his hands. "Quick," he said, and smooched his face with soot, drew a red line across his mouth running from ear to ear. Johnny saw Rab's eyes through the mask of soot. They were glowing with that dark excitement he had seen but twice before. His lips were parted. His teeth looked sharp and white as an animal's. In spite of his calm demeanor, calm voice, he was charged and surcharged with a will to action, a readiness to take and enjoy any desperate chance. Rab had come terrifyingly alive. They flung themselves out of the shop.
"Roundabout!" cried Rab.
He meant they would get to the wharf by back alleys. "Come, follow me."
"Now we're really going to run."
He flew up Salt Lane in the opposite direction from the waterfront. Now they were flinging themselves down back alleys, faster and faster. Once they had a glimpse of a blacksmith shop and other Indians clamoring for soot for their faces. Now slipping over a backyard fence, now at last on the waterfront, C Street, Flounder Alley. They were running so fast it seemed more like a dream of flying than reality. The day had started with rain, and then there had been clouds, but as they reached Griffin's Wharf, the moon, full and white, broke free of the clouds. The three ships, the silent hundreds gathering upon the wharf, all were dipped in the pure white light. The crowds were becoming thousands, and there was not one there but guessed what was to be done, and all approved. Rab was grunting out of the side of his mouth to a thick-set, active-looking man, whom Johnny would have known anywhere by his walk and the confident lift of his head, was Mr. Revere.
"Me know you." "Me know you,"
Johnny repeated this countersign and took his place behind Mr. Revere. The other boys, held up by the crowd, began arriving, and more men and boys. But Johnny guessed that many who were now quietly joining one of those three groups were acting on the spur of the moment, seeing what was up. They had blacked their faces, seized axes, and come along. They were behaving as quietly and were as obedient to their leaders as those who had been so carefully picked for this work of destruction. There was a boatswain's whistle, and in silence one group boarded the Dartmouth. The Eleanor and the Beaver had to be warped into the wharf. Johnny was close to Mr. Revere's heels. He heard him calling for the captain, promising him, in the jargon everyone talked that night, that not one thing should be damaged on the ship except only the tea, but the captain and all his crew had best stay in the cabin until the work was over. Captain Hall shrugged and did as he was told, leaving his cabin boy to hand over the keys to the hold. The boy was grinning with pleasure. The tea party was not unexpected. "I'll show you," the boy volunteered, "how to work them hoists. I'll fetch lanterns, mister." The winches rattled and the heavy chests began to appear, 150 of them. As some men worked into the hold, others broke open the chests and flung the tea into the harbor. But one thing made them unexpected difficulty. The tea inside the chests was wrapped in heavy canvas. The axes went through the wood easily enough. The canvas made endless trouble. Johnny had never worked so hard in his life. He had noticed a stout boy with a blackened face working near him. The boy looked familiar, but when he saw his white, fat hands, Johnny knew who he was and kept a sharp eye on him. It was Dove. He was not one of the original Indians, but a volunteer. He had on an enormous pair of breeches tied at each knee with rope. Even as Johnny upended a chest and helped get the tea over the rail, he kept an eye on Dove. The boy was secretly scooping tea into his breeches. This theft would come to several $100 in value, but more important, it would ruin the high moral tone of the party. Johnny whispered to Rab, who put down the axe he had been wielding with such passion and grabbed Dove. It wasn't much of a scuffle. Soon Dove was whining and admitting that a little of the tea had happened to splash into his breeches. Johnny got them off and kicked them and the many pounds of tea they held into the harbor. "He swim good," he grunted at Rab, for everyone was talking Indian that night. Rab picked up the fat Dove as though he were a rag baby and flung him into the harbor. The tea was thicker than any seaweed, and its fragrance was everywhere. Not a quarter of a mile away, quite visible in the moonlight, rode the Active and the Kingfisher. Any moment the tea party might be interrupted by British Marines. There was no landing party. Governor Hutchinson had been wise in not sending for their help. The work on the Dartmouth and the Eleanor finished about the same time. The Beaver took longer, for she had not had time to unload the rest of her cargo, and great care was taken not to injure it. Just as Johnny was about to go over to see if he could help on the Beaver, Mr. Revere whispered to him, "Go get brooms. Clean 'em deck." Johnny and a parcel of boys brushed the deck until it was clean as a parlor floor. Then Mr. Revere called the captain to come up and inspect. The tea was utterly gone, but Captain Hall agreed that beyond that there had not been the slightest damage. It was close upon dawn when the work on all three ships was done. And yet the great, silent audience on the wharf, men, women, and children, had not gone home. As the three groups came off the ships, they formed in fours along the wharf, their axes on their shoulders. Then a hurrah went up and a fife began to play. This was almost the first sound Johnny had heard since the tea party started. Except only the crash of axes into sea chests, the squeak of hoists, and a few grunted orders. Standing quietly in the crowd, he saw Sam Adams pretending to be a most innocent bystander. It looked to Johnny as if the dog fox had eaten a couple of fat pullets and had a third in his mouth. As they started marching back to the center of town, they passed the coffin house at the head of Griffin's Wharf. A window opened. "Well, boys," said a voice, so cold one hardly knew whether he spoke in anger or not. "You've had a fine, pleasant evening for your Indian caper, haven't you? But mind, you've got to pay the fiddler yet." It was the British Admiral Montague. "Come on down here," someone yelled, "and we'll settle that score tonight." The Admiral pulled in his head and slapped down the window. Johnny and Rab knew, and men like the observers knew, but best of all Sam Adams knew that the fiddler would have to be paid. England, unable to find the individuals who had destroyed this valuable property, would punish the whole town of Boston. Make every man, woman, and child, Tories and Whigs alike, suffer until this tea was paid for. Nor was she likely to back down on her claim that she might tax the colonists any way she pleased. Next day, all over Boston, boys and men, some of them with a little paint still showing behind their ears, were so lame they could scarce move their fingers, but none of them, not one, told what it was that had lamed them so. They would stand about and wonder who those Mohawks might have been, or what the British Parliament might do next, but never say what they themselves had been doing, for each was sworn to secrecy. Only Paul Revere showed no signs of the hard physical strain he had been under all the night before. Not long after dawn he had started on horseback for New York and Philadelphia with an account of the tea party. He could chop open tea chests all night, and ride all day.
Chapter 7 The Fiddler's Bill. But when that bill came, the fiddler's bill, that bill for the tea, it was so much heavier than anyone expected, Boston was thrown into a paroxysm of anger and despair. There had been many a moderate man who had thought the tea party a bit lawless and was now ready to vote payment for the tea. But when these men heard how cruelly the town was to be punished, they swore it would never be paid for. And those other 13 colonies, up to this time many of them had had little interest in Boston's struggles. Now they were united as never before. The punishment united the often jealous, often indifferent, separate colonies as the Tea Party itself had not. Sam Adams was so happy his hands shook worse than ever. For it had been voted in far-off London that the port of Boston should be closed. Not one ship might enter, not one ship might leave the port, except only His Majesty's warships and transports, until the tea was paid for. Boston was to be starved into submission. On that day, that 1st of June, 1774, Johnny and Rab, like almost all the other citizens, did no work, but wandered from place to place over the town. People were standing in angry knots, talking, gesticulating, swearing that, yes, they would starve, they would go down to ruin rather than give in now. Even many of the Tories were talking like that, for the punishment fell equally heavy upon the king's most loyal subjects in Boston and on the very Indians who had tossed the tea overboard. This closing of the port of Boston was indeed tyranny. This was oppression. This was the last straw upon the back of many a moderate man. The boys strolled the waterfront. Here on Long Wharf, merchants' counting houses were closed and shuttered. Sail lofts deserted, the riggers and porters stood idle. Overnight, hundreds of such, and sailors and ropemakers, wharfingers and dockhands, had been thrown out of work. The great ships of Boston, which had been bringing wealth for over 100 years, were idle at their berths. Not one might come and go. At first it was the men of the ships and wharves that were thrown out of work and could not get food for their families. The paralysis that started there would soon spread out and include everybody. For who now could buy new clothes? The clothiers and tailors would close shop. Not one man in Boston could afford a silver basin. The silversmiths would not last long. Nobody could pay rent. The wealthy landowners were headed for bankruptcy. "So," said Rab cheerfully, "looks like we'd all starve together." They stood at the very end of Long Wharf, which ran a half mile out into the harbor. They could see the captain, British flagship, stationed between Long and Hancock's Wharf, and over by Governor's Island, the Lively, and beyond, the Mercury, the Magdalen, the Tartar. His Majesty's fleet surrounded Boston, enforcing the Port Act. "Uncle Lorne is upset. He says the printers will not be able to go on with the newspapers. He won't be able to collect subscriptions, or get any advertising. He won't be able to buy paper nor ink." "He's sending the Webb twins home?" "Yes, back to Chelmsford. But he and I can manage. The Observer is to be half-size. He won't give up. He'll keep on printing, printing, and printing about our wrongs, and our rights, until he drops dead at his press, or gets hanged." There had been a good deal of talk about hanging. Governor Hutchinson was ordered to England. General Gage, from now on, would be in charge. Regiment upon regiment of the finest British troops were arriving. They were planning to put down sedition, all right, and everyone knew that Gage had the right to send any man whom he believed a leader in this revolt against England to London and the parody of a trial, certain death on the gallows. Or, if he wished, Gage might erect his gallows over here. Sam Adams and Hancock, Dr. Warren, perhaps still James Otis, would be the first to go. Certainly all the other members of the Observers, if ever their names were known, would follow, and so would all the Whig printers of Boston. No wonder Uncle Lorne was a little nervous. By nature, he was a timid man, yet timid or bold, he would go on printing, begging the people of Massachusetts to wake up and resist this tyranny before it was too late. He would print until he had not a sheet of paper left to print on, or until the very day the gallows was set up for him. As yet,
Only the British men of war had arrived, but the transports were on the seas. Soon it seemed that almost every day another transport put in. There was the rattle of drums, with the shouts of officers, and off the ships poured a flood, scarlet as a tide of blood. Boston was inundated with British soldiers, and now every third person one met in the street wore the handsome uniform of King George III. There wasn't much work to do. Rab by himself could set the entire newspaper in a day. The subscriptions had dropped, partly because many people could not afford paper, and partly because so many Whig families were leaving Boston for the country. Johnny could deliver the Boston papers in a morning, instead of taking all day. June was ending, and the boys stood about the common watching the soldiers of the 1st Brigade camped there under Earl Percy. Row upon row of identical tents, cook fires, tethered horses of officers, camp followers, stacked muskets, the quick, smart pacing of sentries. All was neat and orderly. Muskets. It was the muskets which interested Rab the most. Already on every village green throughout New England, men and boys were drilling in defiance of the king's orders. They said they were afraid of an attack from the French. These men had no uniforms. They came from the fields and farms in the very clothes they used for plowing. That was all right. But the weapons they brought to their drilling were not. Many had ancient flintlocks, old squirrel guns, handed down for generations. Rab, for instance, all that spring had been going to Lexington once or twice a week to drill with his fellow townsmen. But he could not beg nor buy a decent gun. He drilled with an old fowling piece his grandsire had given him to shoot ducks on the Concord River. Never had Johnny seen Rab so bothered about anything as he was over his inability to get himself a good modern gun. "I don't mind their shooting at me," he would say to Johnny. "And I don't mind shooting at them, but God give me a gun in my hands that can do better than knock over a rabbit at 10 feet. The British soldiers went about their business as though oblivious of the many hostile, curious eyes watching them. They were confident that these provincials, these yokels now gaping at their equipment, gauging the manner of fighting men they were, would be so impressed they would never stand up and fight them. Rab, so concerned over a gun as he was, did an uncharacteristic foolish thing. The two boys were standing close to a stack of muskets. As Rab explained to Johnny their good points, he put out a hand and touched the lock on one. Without even showing bad temper, almost impartially, a mounted officer sitting his horse close by chatting with a couple of Boston's Tory girls, swung about and struck Rab a heavy blow on the side of his head with the flat of his sword. Then he went on flirting with the girls as though nothing had happened. Rab never knew what hit him. Now a sergeant came bawling, "Spectators are not to intrude. Get back behind them ropes. Get back, all of you, get back." Johnny stayed where he was, beside the unconscious Rab. Yet, after this act of sudden violence, the boys were well treated. Johnny was not run through because he stayed with his friend, did not obey the sergeant. A gray, older man, a medical officer, approached, called for water, sponged Rab's face for him, and said he was coming too. Johnny was not to worry. What was he doing? Just looking at a gun. Touching it? Well, yes. And only got hit over the head. He got off easy. Filching a soldier's arms is a serious misdemeanor. Wonder Lieutenant Bragg didn't kill him. Rab said thickly, "I hadn't thought to filch it. Not a bad idea. I guess I'll... He was still groggy from the blow. "If I ever get a chance, I'll..." The medical man only laughed at him. "Now, boys," he said seriously, "you forget talk like that. You remember that we don't like being here in Boston any better than you like having us. I'd rather be with my wife and children in Bath. We're both in a tight spot. But if we keep our tempers and you keep your tempers, why, we can fix things up between us somehow. We're all one people, you know." As he talked, Johnny had an experience he was to have many more times. The troops would do something he considered unforgivable, like nearly braining Rab for merely touching a gun, and then the next moment be so civil and friendly he could not help but like them, at least some of them, as individuals. The medical man, noticing Johnny's riding boots and spurs, was saying, "I've a cousin lives over in Cambridge. Haven't had a chance to send him a letter. Do either of you know a boy with a good horse who could ride for me?" Rab was mouthing yes at Johnny. "I've got a good horse. Come to me at 1 o'clock sharp this noon. I'm quartered on Mr. Shaw, North Square." On the way home, Rab said, "If you can get started carrying messages for him, others may follow. Might be we could learn things Sam Adams and Dr. Warren and Paul Revere would like to know. They wouldn't dare send their own orderlies, fearful somebody might kill them. I'd thought of that myself." But at 1 o'clock, as he stood beside Goblin in North Square, receiving money and the letter from the medical captain, also a pleasant smile, one thing upset him. Paul Revere's house was almost next door. There was a girl there about his age. She was standing before her house, almost bent horizontal at the hips. She was sticking out at him the longest, reddest tongue he had ever seen. And as he mounted and swung about to leave the British officer, he heard her shrilling in a horrible sing-song, "He loves the British, he loves the British." But that night, on his return, when he went to tell Mr. Revere, there was no question but that Mr. Shurtleff of Cambridge, always considered a lukewarm Whig, was in reality a leader of Tories in Middlesex County, he saw little Miss Revere again. "Father says," she apologized handsomely, "that I'm not to believe everything I see, and..." "Believe anything you like." Johnny was feeling good. He had charged the medical man 3 times the price he would have dared charge a Yankee, and by what Mr. Shurtleff had said to his wife on reading this letter, he had found out something worth, not much, but at least worth knowing. "I like to see you stick out your tongue," he went on. "It is so long and red, I thought at first it was a hound dog dressed up in pink petticoats. I never guessed it was a young lady." 2. Now Johnny no longer kept half the money he and Goblin earned carrying letters. He charged the British officers such a figure, and they never complained. He was bringing in a considerable sum, and he gave it all to Aunt Lorne to buy food for her family, of which he was one. At first she wouldn't take it. Then she cried and kissed him on the little peak of hair that turned down upon his forehead, and did take it. No gallows was set up to hang rebels. General Gage was doing his best to make friends with the people of Boston. He did not stop the flood of treasonable oratory which poured forth from men like Warren and Quincy. He did not prohibit the publication of such inflammatory presses as The Observer. The Whigs had their say. The papers were allowed to print outrageous things about himself and his troops. He was not brilliant, but he was no tyrant. In time, he confidently expected all the trouble would smooth out by itself, if only the soldiers and the inhabitants did not get to quarreling. Nor did Boston starve. From one end of the Atlantic seaboard to the other, towns and even villages sent great shipments of food. Rice from South Carolina, or quintals of fish from Marblehead. Money even from London, for there was much sympathy in England for Boston. Flour, corn, beef, sheep, all day were passing through the town gates upon the neck, in carts and wagons. This was the only road connecting Boston with the mainland. Formerly, almost everything she used came to her on her hundreds of famous ships. Now the ships were lying like dead birds along her wharves. So July was ending. Johnny had not seen Priscilla Lapham for 3 weeks. His schedule was now so much upset, he never did know when he would be in North Square on a Thursday. And every Sunday of late he had gone out to Lexington to watch the Minutemen drilling, a little secretly, behind Grandsire Silsby's great barn. It might be Sabbath-breaking, but these men were so sure they were doing God's will in preparing to resist tyranny they did not care. Johnny could only stand and watch. True enough, there were boys no older than he drilling there, but his crippled hand made it impossible for him to pull a trigger. This incapacity fretted him badly, and he would sometimes take it out on Rab. The militia troops didn't look like much. They had funny-looking guns. They were funny-looking men, and... Rab let him talk. He knew why Johnny was criticizing. It was because he could not be one himself. So he had not seen Scylla since late in June. Thus far, she had never once come to the Observer's office in Salt Lane. It was as if she recognized it as that other world into which Johnny Tremaine had disappeared, and knew that she could not follow him. So Johnny was surprised one afternoon, riding back from Plymouth where he had delivered a letter for Major Pitcairn, to find her sitting in the shop with Rab. She did not look at all forlorn, in her fresh lavender muslin frock, her neat white stockings and black pumps. Her head was tipped back and she was laughing. She had been drawing a picture and Rab was telling her what to draw. For once, for the first time since Johnny had left the Laphams, Izana was not with her. Johnny was so glad to see her, he wondered could it have been that it was Izana always hanging on to her, always showing off that it irritated him, made him not care whether he kept his rendezvous with the girls or not. As he came in, booted and spurred, sunburned and hatless, Scylla glanced at him. Her eyes were happy, filled to the brim with happiness. She had been having such a good time with Rab. And unconsciously and unreasonably, Johnny stiffened. He couldn't see why she and Rab should be having such a good time. They were explaining. Rab had wanted a picture of Boston being strangled to death by a British grenadier. It was for the newspaper, and she, Scylla, having chanced in, had drawn it beautifully, and now Johnny would have to cut a block of it for printing. "I can do it. Not very well, of course, but I can. You certainly can draw better and better." "Mr. Tweedy can draw. He's giving me lessons." And Rab posed for the British grenadier. "Look, I've pictures of him here."
"Those? Rab? They look more like woodchucks than Rab to me," he said. But Scylla knew he thought they were fine pictures, and he was proud of her. She was so pretty, Johnny could hardly think where all this prettiness came from, and sourly he thought it came from Rab. He had a way of lighting people up, showing them at their best.
No, partly at least it was because of that lavender dress, and her face had color in it because she was eating enough.
When the troops came and times were so hard, Scylla had always given a large share of her food to Izana and had grown to look more peaked and worried every week. Now she looked fine.
"Sit there, like that, Johnny. I'm going to draw you, too. You're easier than Rab."
"Why am I easier than Rab?"
"Because," she said, intentionally hurting his feelings, "you're just a child yet. Rab's grown up."
"There. You don't mind if I make you look a little like a raccoon, do you?"
"I'll draw a bushy tail for you, Scylla," Rab said.
Johnny fidgeted, as people do who are having their pictures drawn, crazy to see what somebody else thinks they look like. It wasn't much of a picture. Between them, they had drawn a funny half-raccoon, half-boy. Somehow it did look like Johnny, and they all laughed.
4 o'clock. I must be getting back. I was told to pick up a pair of gloves on Queen Street and be back at 5.
She got up, tied a flowered bonnet on her head, and started for the door.
"Wait, Scylla, you haven't told me any news."
He had forgotten how recently her news had bored him.
"That's right. I've just told Rab. Johnny, I won't be able to meet you regularly anymore. Things have changed."
"How so? Your mother mad?"
"No. That is, yes, she is mad, but about something else. She's mad because Dorcas really did have the guts to run off and marry Frizzell Jr. just as soon as Mr. Tweedy declared for her."
"Dorcas isn't going to get much of that elegance she was always out after from Frizzell Jr.
"No, but she doesn't care."
The young girl's voice softened. "She says when you really are in love, you don't care much about anything. Except him." Johnny, remembering the gawky, callow, but upstanding young leather dresser of Fish Street, was surprised that anyone could value him so highly.
"She ran off with Frizzell Jr. just as soon as Mr. Tweedy came out and said he preferred her to Madge. But what put Ma right through the roof was when he said he was in no hurry. He didn't mind passing up Madge and waiting for me."
"You?" cried Johnny hotly. "That old man! If he is a man! Why, he must be about 40. Scylla, you're lying to me if you say anybody's talking of marrying you."
"I was 15 last month, and you were 15 way back in January. I'd not stop to think.
Rab, did you hear that?
I'm only a year younger than you are now.
Rab grinned.
I was 17 last week.
Johnny thought that was like Rab, slipping off by himself, getting ahead of you, and then grinning at you out of the corner of his mouth. Mother didn't like it, Mr. Tweedy stalling like that. And then one thing happened after another.
For instance?
Ever since, well, last fall, the lights have been giving us work to do. Mr. Tweedy is clever, although so queer. A couple of weeks ago, Miss Light came in. She wanted her arms, that old rising sun, engraved on the top of her riding whip. So she stands about, and I stand about, and Mr. Tweedy and Ma. The shop door was open into the backyard, and Izana was standing about, too, in the backyard.
I'll bet she was.
Yes, Miss Lavinia just about had a fit.
What was Izana doing?
Throwing up. I had just washed her hair, said Scylla dreamily, and the sun was on it.
Oh, I see, said Johnny sourly.
And Izana was walking back and forth reciting some poetry to herself, acting it out. Something about Captain Kidd and how he sailed. Old Stumpy Joe, the one-legged sailor man, taught it to her. Miss Lavinia stood there watching Izana, and she looked more like something cut out of stone than a human being.
She can't help it, said Johnny, who liked to run her down.
She was born that way. Go on.
She just turned her head like that and said to Ma through her teeth like this, Ma'am, I'm taking that child with me.
Ma first said she wouldn't, and then said she couldn't stand between Izana and such an opportunity. And Izana said she wouldn't go without me. So it was fixed this way. I'm signed up to work in the kitchen or help Miss Lavinia dress or anything for a year, and Izana is thrown in for nothing, because she's so young and has a delicate stomach. We're both living with the lights.
Do you like her?
Sometimes. Well, yes.
Well, I think she's disagreeable.
He hoped Scylla would contradict him, but she did not. So now I'll be going back. She only gave me the afternoon off. I thought I'd tell you not to look for me around North Square anymore.
Johnny felt guilty.
I do leave a paper at the lights every Thursday.
Scylla said nothing, but looked at him out of the corners of her eyes.
Couldn't I see you sometime? Maybe?
I don't know. You might ask Mrs. Bessie, the cook. She's sort of a friend of mine.
So, goodbye. I'll be going on.
Scylla had changed so much Johnny felt confused. One thing was certain. She wasn't going to hang around and wait for him either on street corners or at back doors, and then not have him show up.
Goodbye, Scylla. I'll see you soon.
But Rab did not say goodbye. He did not even ask her if he might walk home with her to Beacon Hill. He simply went, and Johnny was mad. If anyone walked home with Scylla, it should be himself, or Rab might have said, Come on, Johnny, we'll both walk over to the lights with Scylla. But he'd forgive Rab for intruding himself. He'd cook him up a mess of eggs for supper. It would take about 15 minutes to go to the lights, 15 minutes to get back. He built the fire and cooked the eggs. He cooked them and cooked them. At last, in disgust, he took them off and ate them, every now and then going down to consult the shop clock. Rab was gone for exactly 1 hour and 47 minutes. Nor did he miss the eggs Johnny had eaten. He had been very well fed by Mrs. Bessie in the light kitchen, and he thought Scylla was a grand kid. He had had a good time. You could see it in his eyes, and whenever he looked at Johnny's long face, he looked ready to laugh. 3. Now the only regularity in Johnny's life was the great effort he made to see Scylla every Thursday and the care he gave to Goblin. But when he went to the Afric Queen, he was going into enemy territory. The tavern had been taken over bodily by British officers. Chief among them was Colonel Francis Smith. Goblin was the only horse in the stable that did not belong to a British officer, for the landlord had sent his to the country, fearing they would either be commandeered by the occupying troops, or that he could not get hay for them. About the stables, British orderlies, officers, servants, and small British horse-boys, the servants of the servants, were always congregating. Johnny paid little heed to them. They all knew that he rode for the Observer, but they also knew that he often rode for their own officers. Sometimes they picked on him. And once, when things got too bad and he felt he had to fight it out with the worst bully, the other boys, all his enemies, stood about demanding fair play, saying, "Well fought, Yankee, and that's neat," when he beat the bully. He had rather thought the whole gang would be on him the second he got the bully down. Instead, they merely respected him. So he made out better than he could have expected until one day he found that Colonel Smith had a new horse boy. The one he had brought over with him had run away, so he had told his orderly officer to find a new one, and that boy was Dove. Johnny saw him grinning sheepishly at him, hoping they might be friends. They, the only two local boys at the stable. "You," Johnny muttered out of the corner of his mouth, "you trash, you milk pudding, you cottage cheese slug. So, you're not above going to work for them, are you?" "Honest, Johnny, I gotta eat. Old Tweety fired me." An orderly stuck his head in the stable. "Boy," he said to Johnny, "Colonel Smith has a letter to go to Milton. Please go to the parlor and see him or Lieutenant Stranger about it." A slow, gat-toothed grin spread over Dove's face. "Looks like you work for them, too." "Looks like," said Johnny fiercely. He saw the colonel, went home for his boots and spurs, then took out Goblin and saddled him. One of the English boys had got Dove down and was twisting his arm, making him swear allegiance to His Britannic Majesty, Gracious George III. Dove was swearing fast enough and protesting that that was the way he really felt. All rebels should be hung. Johnny had a queer feeling at the pit of his stomach. He wanted to go to his rescue. He had to make himself remember that he hated Dove. "But that fellow over there," Dove was pointing to Johnny, "is really on the other side, and..." Johnny left Dove to his fate. It was a crisp, fresh day for summer, the first respite after a week of unendurable heat. Goblin felt fine. He came sidling out of the stable, dancing and playing. Johnny let him move about, get the kinks out of him. He loved the horse. He loved the admiration he saw on every face. Grooms dropping curry combs, officers looking out of windows and talking to each other and nodding toward Goblin, chambermaids, rich Tory gentlemen, all stopped to stare when Goblin played. Although he mostly kept his eyes on Goblin's wickedly flattened ears, it is the only way you can tell which way a horse will jump next. He did notice a thick, red face at the parlor window, Colonel Smith, and he heard his booming voice. "Boy, one moment." Doubtless he had changed his mind about that letter for Milton. Lieutenant Stranger, his orderly officer, was coming out of the parlor. He had on no hat. His spurs were in his hand. He was a dark, young fellow, not much older than Rab, and something in both his color and carriage had always made Johnny think of Rab. "That's quite a horse you have there." "He's all right." "Well, we sort of hate to see a damned Yankee on top of a good horse like that. How much will you take?" "He belongs to my master, Mr. Lorne." "Colonel Smith," he called to the stiff red face at the window, "this horse belongs to Lorne, the printer. Boston Observer, you know. We can commandeer him, all right." "You fix a proper price." "So, boy, how much will your master take for him?" "He's not for sale." "Oh, he isn't, is he? You know damned little about the rights of His Majesty's armed forces." "You get off, and I'll try him around the block and see how I think he would suit Colonel Smith." He knelt and buckled on his spurs. The handsome black washerwoman of the inn, Lydia, came out carrying a hamper of wet clothes. Johnny had an idea. "All right, Lieutenant Stranger," he said politely. "Put the stirrups down a couple of notches. Now, hand me my gloves."
I'll be back in 10 minutes.
Goblin was watching out of the corner of his crystalline blue eyes. Not for months had anyone but Johnny Tremaine been on his back. But the lieutenant mounted confidently, picked up